Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, December 31st, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, folks, it's one of our best ofs as we continue our vacation 2018. This is a great one. Fascinating story with Professor Annalisa Cox. America's forgotten black pioneers and the struggle for equality. Fascinating story of a forgotten piece of history that shows that when you hear, I mean, you probably know this, but the racist tropes of black people underperforming in society, which you know, supposedly is the basis of much of the racism that we hear. Well, here's a story of black people overperforming in society that also spurred white racism. I know, surprise, surprise, but it is a fascinating story that is important for all of us to know. And then following that, Matt's Picks, special compilation of some of the fun half stuff so that you can all get a taste of it. And folks, just want to say, obviously it's New Year's Eve day. And I can't, on behalf of everybody on the crew, and frankly, on behalf of, you know, the listeners, too, because, you know, the thing about our audience is not only do I appreciate beyond words the support that you have given the show and, frankly, me over the years. I appreciate your listening, but I also, it's super gratifying to hear from you about how much the show means, whether it's emails or phone calls or whatever. But it's also when there are stories of people who listen to the show and the community that is formed around it, when members of that community are going through difficult times, or when members of that community have a cause that they are working on. This community has risen to the challenge. I mean, not even the challenge. We don't even have to issue a challenge. It's not, I mean, people respond within this community in a way that is incredibly gratifying. And really, I mean, it's just gratifying being part of it, but it really, frankly, you know, has less to do with me and us and more to do with you. And so I'm not very good at showing gratitude over the course of the year. I'm a little bit, you know, remote sometimes, I've been told. Not that I listened. But I do want to just thank you and express my gratitude since it's the last day of 2018. And hopefully I can get through all of 2019 and just wait till the last day to do that again. But seriously, thank you so much for all your support and for listening. And, you know, 2019, it's going to be great. Meanwhile, what if 2019 was all about slowing down and being mindful? I feel like Michael should be here for this. But imagine how many goals you could accomplish then. That's why This show is excited to partner with Calm, the number one app to help you meditate, sleep, and relax. Practices like meditation and prioritizing sleep can leave you feeling more rested, so you have the energy to go out and achieve your goals. I'll tell you something. For me, 2019 is going to be the year of sleep. Saul, I think, is done peeing his bed. And that means I've got an open opportunity to get some sleep, and I need it. And if you head to calm.com/majority, you're going to get 25% off a Calm premium subscription, which includes hundreds of hours of programs like guided meditations on issues like anxiety, stress, and focus, including a brand new meditation each day called the Daily Calm. Sleep stories, which are bedtime stories for adults designed to help you relax before you doze off. Head to the lavender fields of France with Stephen Fry. Or explore New Zealand with Jerome Flynn from Game of Thrones. For a limited time, Majority Report listeners get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/majority. That's calm.com/majority. You get unlimited access to all of Calm's content today at calm.com/majority. Give yourself the gift of calm and start 2019 off right. And lastly, even if we all skimp on that full night of sleep, or skip a workout, or brush our teeth with a tired old toothbrush, we can do better, folks. We're not perfect, but we can do better. And Quip is the better electric toothbrush that can help. Guess what I just got? Well, not when you're hearing this, but a week before you're hearing this.
Replacement?
No. Ordered an all black.
The handle?
All black.
Wow.
The all black toothbrush. I'm super psyched. I can't believe I'm this excited about getting a toothbrush. But some electric toothbrushes are too abrasive. Quip has sensitive sonic vibrations for an effective clean that's gentle on your sensitive gums. Folks, this is hugely important. Believe me. You get to be my age, you start to realize I totally messed up 15 years ago when it came to my dental hygiene. Plus, it's got a built-in two-minute timer, pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides. The multi-use cover works as a stand. It mounts to mirrors. It slides over your bristles to pack and protect your Quip on the go. No wonder Quip is one of the first electric toothbrushes accepted by the American Dental Association with thousands of verified five-star reviews. You know why I love my Quip. Because I say this time and time again. Doesn't matter what kind of fancy electric toothbrush you have if you don't use it. The Quip is convenient. It has all the same features that an electric toothbrush has, but it's designed in a slim way so you can actually put it on your narrow sink top or you can travel with it. The key to getting good dental hygiene is to use your toothbrush. That's why I love my Quip. And with over 1 million happy, healthy mouths, they do too. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/majority, right now you can get your first refill pack for free. That's the other great thing about it. They keep sending you refill packs every 3 months so you never have a crappy brush head. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com. That's getquip.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Come back, America's forgotten black pioneers in the struggle for equality. With Annalisa Cox. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program a fellow at Harvard's Hutchins Center for African and African American Research and the author of The Bone and Sinew of the Land, the Unfairly Forgotten Story of African American Pioneers. Annalisa Cox, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So let's I should say it's actually your subtitle of your book is America's Forgotten Black Pioneers and the Struggle for Equality. But it is a forgotten story of African-American pioneers nonetheless. So let's just start where we're talking about. What period of time have you examined here?
Well, it's much, much earlier than anyone has acknowledged or recognized. So this is right after the American Revolution. So, you know, for all of those Hamilton fans out there, this is your bag. So this is the period right after the American Revolution all the way to the Civil War. So the assumption has long been that this region of land, which honestly, I know, is often called the flyover zone, right? For all the coastal livers in America, but more commonly called the Midwest. But at the time that this history is taking place, it is called the Great West, capital G, capital W. It's actually our first free frontier. If you look at maps from the 1790s, this is before the Louisiana Purchase. So this space makes sort of doubles the size of the 13 colonies. It's a massive piece of land. And in 1787, there's an ordinance written for it at the same time that our national constitution is being written. But in many ways, this ordinance is the best ideals of the American Revolution put down on paper. It's only 4 pages long. And the people who wrote it had to deal with a lot less cooks in the kitchen than the people who wrote our national constitution. So they had a lot more leeway. And so two of the things that they did that were truly revolutionary is that they made it free of slavery, which made it the largest piece of the New World to be set aside as free from slavery up until that point. The previous one being Georgia, but that's a whole different story. Mm-hmm. So this is the Northwest Territory, and not only is it free from slavery, it has equal voting rights. Now, to be fair, you had to be a man, you had to be over the age of 21, you had to own land, but it didn't matter whether you were white or black. You could vote. And this may sound really strange for the 18th century, right? Except that we've lost so much of our American history that another fact that we've kind of lost is that by 1792, when George Washington ran for president his second term, the vast majority of American states had equal voting rights for black and white men, including a lot of slaveholding states. So unless we can unbury, uncover, and reclaim this lost history, not only of the revolutionary moves forward that were being made for equality and freedom in this nation early, early on, but also this massive first great migration, the movement of tens of thousands of free African Americans onto this free frontier, starting in the late 18th century, we lose a lot of guideposts about where our nation has been and, honestly, where it's going today.
Well, the thing that really I find fascinating about this, and I have half a dozen questions just on what you just said, but the thing that I think it really shows is that you can go backwards. You know, like we have this perspective of history and of, I guess, some sense of enlightenment, moving slowly forward. But you can go backwards. And that's what I find absolutely fascinating about this. So we should just say, so when we say Northwest Territory, just so that we're clear, we're talking like Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, right? Indiana.
Right. This is Ohio. Right.
It was Northwest Territory in the late 1700s, as opposed to, you know, I think people today, when you hear Northwest Territory, they assume, you know, there must be, Washington State or something like that. How is it, like, how did, were these African American, essentially pioneers who were homesteaders, where did they come from? Like, were they freed slaves? Were they folks who had purchased their own freedom? I mean, where did this population come from?
Well, this was a really, really fascinating group of people, and they were so diverse. There were just so many varieties of people. Now, very, very few African-descended people arrived on these shores free, right? So let's be really clear about that. But for some of these pioneers, they had been free in the New World in America long before there was a United States. By starting the 1600s, there are people who are arriving on this frontier whose fathers fought in the American Revolution as patriots, who they themselves fought in the War of 1812, all up and down the Wabash River, including in the Battle of Tippecanoe. And so these are incredibly patriotic and deeply American individuals. Many of them were a fascinating group, which I have termed freedom entrepreneurs. So these are people who were working overtime in slavery, as enslaved people, to gain extra money in order to purchase their freedom. And this was a really tough thing to do because you can't exactly negotiate with a person who owns you and your labor, right? So oftentimes they're being charged usury rates, like double the market value for themselves. And once they came up with the money, it could just be taken by the person who enslaved them, right? And the entire thing, I mean, the whole thing was set up for corruption. But actually, there were thousands of these freedom entrepreneurs who were coming onto this Northwest territorial frontier long before the Civil War. And as I describe in my book, The Bone and Sinew of the Land, they are rejecting the culture that they came from. So they're coming from this culture, this enslaving culture. Some of them are actually being sold by their own family members, by their fathers, by their half-brothers, by their own cousins, all of whom are white, and who consider themselves owners of these blood relatives of themselves. But they are prioritizing profit over family. So these whites are selling their own kin in order to make money. And those kinfolk are then deciding to reject that culture and prioritize family over profit. So they are coming to the frontier, having purchased their freedom, and then they are homesteading land, purchasing land from the federal government, really good land, they're farming it well, and then as they make money as farmers, they are purchasing their family's freedom, their daughters and their wives and their mothers, and they are putting back their families again.
Fascinating. And we're talking about, is it 63,000 people at this time?
This is, by 1860, there are over 63,000 African-descended people in this region who are counted. And I want to stress the word counted because this is a federal document. And problems with the census and race are not new.
Right.
And problems with the federal government and race are not new. So there were some of these African-descended pioneers who refused to be counted on the federal census record, especially after the horrific law, the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, was passed, which took away their right to habeas corpus and a right to trial by jury. And there were some people like John Langston, who was the first African-American to be elected to political office in this nation in a free and open election. And yes, he was living on a successful large farm that he owned in rural Ohio. He wasn't living in Boston or New York. That first was from this region, and he refused to allow himself to be counted in the federal census, even though he was a young lawyer, the first African-American lawyer to become a lawyer in the state of Ohio. He did it out of protest for what the federal government was doing. So I want to say the number 63,000 is very conservative. It's also a state's worth, because the Northwest Territorial Ordinance of 1787 clearly outlines that in order to become a state, a region of the territory must have at least 60,000 non-native people living in it in order to become a state. So this is over a state's worth of free African Americans living integrated and scattered across this region. And the fact that we have lost this history, I'm still, it just still baffles me. I love talking with high school students about this history. And the other day I was in Brooklyn talking to a group of brilliant young high school students at Boys Hope, Girls Hope. And we were talking about sort of how we could compare this lost history and saying it would be a little bit like in a few weeks. Okay, just imagine. This is just pretend, right? Don't be alarmed, folks. But if in a few weeks the federal government decided to make it illegal for anybody of African descent to play professional sports in America. Say somebody got upset about the Take a Knee movement or something, and this law was passed. So all of a sudden, no one of African descent is allowed, we're imagining, right, is no longer allowed to play professional sports. Then, spool forward a century or 150 years, and the fact that there had been successful athletes, the fact that there had been a Venus Williams or a LeBron James has been forgotten amongst the society at large. And historians are now arguing that African Americans have never been good at sports.
Right.
And that's what the textbooks say, too. And so if then an historian all of a sudden says, oh, there was this person called Venus Williams and this person called LeBron James who were extraordinary sports folks and athletes 150 years ago, what if the nation at that point said, oh, well, so what? You know, what does that mean? Well, when you lose an aspect of the American past that is this large, that a nation loses a sense of identity of what it can be, who it is now and who it can be. And so this history, I've done my best to unbury it, and it took a lot of work, it took a lot of digging. Well, but it also has to be reclaimed.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, just what is the analogy to that in the analogy you just gave? What was analogous in that time to that law that said African American people can't play sports? I mean, what was it that, so you've got, you know, a 70-year period of what appears to be, you know, almost full, I mean, would you describe it as basically full rights that are afforded black folk during this time?
No. So here's the interesting thing. So the Northwest Territorial Ordinance, and if anybody wants to look it up, it's up on the Library of Congress website, and if anybody can find the word white in that document, I'll give them $5. I promise, I'm good for it.
Okay.
But it's... The word white is left out of that document deliberately because entire states, recent colonies, are removing the word white from their state constitutions, including Georgia, which is really shocking, in order to open up equal rights to people of African descent. And this is all happening in the late 18th century. So this is the founding law for this entire region. But as each state is carved out of this region, the white majority in those states institute prejudice into their laws. So Ohio's the first, around 1803, they add the word white into their state constitution, thus excluding the African American pioneers who are already in that region, who are already succeeding. And this is what I want to stress, that the racism that arose in this region arose in the face of black success, not the face of black failure. This is really, really important for us to remember today, especially when we think about things like anti-immigration laws and the way and boundaries and borders. Because the first anti-immigration laws passed in this nation were passed against African Americans in the Midwest before the Civil War. The entire state of Illinois and the entire state of Indiana banned further African-American immigration after whites in that region started coming in and discovering that African-Americans had come in early, had gotten really good land, and were succeeding massively. I mean, these were hugely wealthy and successful farms scattered across this region.
Wow. And so as these as more white people enter into this territory, they hit the threshold to create a they have the density, I guess, to apply and then get statehood. They're adding this element to their constitution and to their laws, a race conscious, I guess, element. And so what are the series of laws that begin to, I mean, do these folks by the late 1800s, by the time we get to the mid to late 1800s, we get to the Civil War, have they been dispossessed of this property? I mean it's an amazing story, because when you look at the one of the fundamental disadvantages that black people have had in this country in terms of building wealth has been an inability to own their own homes or to own essentially land and property. And so what happens? Once Ohio does that in 1803, and they do it, as you say, as a weapon to to gain a competitive edge, it feels like.
Absolutely.
And
Absolutely.
So what are they? What are those laws that are passed?
Well, this is the really painful and difficult part, but it's a two-part story, right? It's a story of rising beyond what we have ever recognized or acknowledged in the American past, of African Americans rising and succeeding as a group across this region. And it's I was talking to somebody in Detroit the other day, and she said she was thinking about the book, and she said, farmers, farming, like, what does that have to do with anything today? But actually, in those days, the American dream was to own good land and farm it well. Sure. I mean, this is before there was a city of Chicago, before there was a city of Milwaukee, right? This is frontier. This is our nation's earliest frontier.
This is where wealth is built, right?
I mean, right.
This is exactly,
and we're watching it. You can watch it. I mean, in the book, and I want to be really clear, you and I are having this kind of theoretical conversation, right? But this, I want to encourage your listeners that this book, I promise, it's not boring, right? These are really heroic individuals.
I think people are interested right now. I mean, of course, I'm maybe professionally deluded on a daily basis. But I mean, and yes, and you tell the stories of individuals, and that you have dug up. But I think it's fascinating to know too that, broadly speaking, there's this dispossession. And so, I mean, what are the laws, though, what type of laws are passed that fall from these rights being limited to white people? Like, what is the cascading things?
One of the earliest laws passed in what is at a certain point called the Indiana Territory, but included the entire Northwest Territory except for the state of Ohio. So we're talking Michigan, Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana, like this just massive region. And this is really early. This is before this region even had states carved out of it. Governor William Henry Harrison passed a law with what I could say were some corrupt judges, not his own father-in-law, who was trying desperately hard to preserve liberty and freedom for all in this region. But the young William Henry Harrison managed to push through a law which said that people of African descent could not testify or take to court a white person. So this is called your word or your oath, right? But this means that if you're a wealthy African American farmer on 900 acres of land, you're basically a millionaire by today's standards. You're hiring almost everybody in your county to harvest your wheat every fall. I mean, white or black, you're kind of landed gentry, right? But you and your large family are all African American. And say a group of men come up to your house one evening, and they walk into your barn, and they take out your four best milk cows, and they walk away with them. Well, if the only witnesses to that act are you and your family members, you cannot take them to court and you cannot testify against them. So it's extremely difficult to run any kind of business or be any kind of an entrepreneur if you lose your privilege to the court, right? So that's one of the earliest. And then there starts being anti-immigration laws, and these are always coded, right? The language, fake news isn't new. I'm just going to say this.
Right.
But the language in the newspapers is, oh, well, we want to keep fugitive slaves from the state, right, or from our regions. So there's things called black code bonds that are passed, and these say that if you're of African descent and you enter a state, you have to be registered with the local white county clerk, and you have to promise or even pay a $500 to $1,000 bond. Now, in 1810, 1820, 1830, this is a fortune.
Right.
To put this into perspective, $500 in 1825 was what it cost the city of New York to buy a fire engine. Now, admittedly, it's not a big motorized vehicle.
Right.
It's a wagon with brass buckets and a pump and hose that's going to be pulled by horses, but it's still an immensely expensive endeavor for the city of New York to do. But meanwhile, you're an African-American pioneer trying to make it, and you're being told, if you're going to come into the state and come with the money to purchase land, you also have to make sure you have $500 just lying around for your bond.
And we
should
say,
Illinois, it was $1,000.
And presumably, this person has somehow managed to raise the money to free themselves, right? I mean, so it's
many
not like
them.
There's you are severely limiting the people that can enter in. And what, I mean, what impact did that have? I mean, because you've already got, right, by 1860, 63,000 people in that region. What impact did that have by keeping, I guess, more African-Americans out from that region?
So that is the million-dollar question, right? That's the what-if question. Historians love to ask these questions. We can't really know. But I think there's a map in the front of the book that starts to give an indication. The three border states, which are all along either.
Yep.
Yeah, that are all along the waterways. And this is before highways and trains and airplanes. So the way you want to get to where you're going is water. So the best land is going to be the land closest to the river. And the border states of Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois are the ones that are filling up with pioneers the quickest, black and white. But by 1860, the state of Illinois has half the number of African-American farming settlements that Ohio and Indiana have. And Illinois was the first to institute a $1,000 black code bond. So these absolutely had an impact. They had an effect. And we can't know, could there have been double? I mean, I found well over 300 of these settlements scattered across this region by the Civil War. Could there have been 600? Could there have been 1,000? Could there have been, you know, over 200,000 African-descended people or more living in this region if these laws had not been passed? I don't know if we can know that.
Right.
But they certainly had an effect.
So what happened to this wealth? I mean, did this wealth survive? I mean, you know, you've described at least in one instance where you have lost essentially the ability to protect your property, right? I mean, with,
right,
like, people could just start building on your land, I guess, theoretically. And if you can't take them to court and you can't testify in court, you don't really have a way of protecting your wealth and your source of wealth. I mean, what happened to this wealth? Did any of that survive, or was it were people just dispossessed? Where did these folks go, or where did their, I guess, descendants go?
Well, some of them are still there, and I want to be clear. the Midwest, the Great West, the Northwest Territory is not monolithic. Each of these states, each of these regions, even each of these counties are different. So some had large, large settlements. Cass County, Michigan had over 600 African Americans living in it. This is a rural county in southern Michigan by 1860. And some of them, there were people, there were white neighbors who came in after these early African American pioneers who were tolerant. Some were actually welcoming. Some were allies. So while there was this kind of prejudice and racism that was rising, there was also resistance to it, and resistance in ways that the Northeast had already lost. So there were revolutionary schools being built in Indiana cornfields in the 1840s, which were pre-collegiate boarding institutions that were not only integrated racially, but they were integrated with gender. I mean, the idea of educating young women for college in the 1840s is also revolutionary. But then it's also black and white teenagers all boarding. I mean, they've got their own, you know, there's the boys' dorm and the girls' dorm, but they're dating. And this is all happening in the 1840s in rural Indiana at a time when in rural Connecticut, such a school for wealthy African American girls was almost burned to the ground with them in their beds in order to shut that school down. So there were spaces and places for that wealth to be used. And that school was not started by whites. It was started by African American farmers, wealthy farmers, using their money to start that school. These farmers were helping to found and run the Black Convention movement. Now, this is a movement that's been almost entirely lost to history. But these were annual conventions where African Americans from across these states would gather and organize. They'd write articles for newspapers. They'd petition their local politicians. They would protest the loss of their voting rights and the loss of their equal rights. And in Ohio, they were so successful that they actually had some of the Black Code laws reversed by 1849 in that state. This is not a story just of overwhelming horror. This is a story of resistance to that. So, for example, John Langston, who actually happens to be Langston Hughes' great uncle, the famous poet. But when he ran for his position in rural Ohio in the 1850s, he was elected to that office by a mainly white electorate. And this complicates so many notions we have about white versus black and North versus South. All of this just gets hugely complicated in all of the variety of things that were happening. But there's so much. By losing this population, by losing its history, we've lost all of that.
But do we have numbers on what survived? I mean, would that school that you described, had that been founded by white people and had it been for white people, would that school now be a prestigious national, you know, well-known school, you know? Or I guess this is what I'm asking is, like,
yeah,
you know, to what extent was all this, you know, again, like, do we have a sense of whether or not this wealth was lost? Can we track it? I mean, do
you know, that is, I end my book with the Civil War, and I'm really curious about this, Sam. I'd like to know. I mean, I wish I could say that in the Bone and Sinew of the Land that I was able to go right up to the present day, but that would have probably been about 10 books and
right,
it wouldn't have been finished yet. So, but what I can say is, not all of these communities are gone, but what arose in this region after the Civil War, and particularly with the rise of the Klan in
right,
the rural Midwest in the 1920s, I think that the word pogrom is not inappropriate. And so the level of violence, once they got their rights after the Civil War, and I often say, you know, I know that Abraham Lincoln was shot by a Southerner, but I often think about that speech he gave in which he you know, he thinks it's his first speech after the Civil War. We all know it's his last speech. But he starts talking about opening up the vote to African Americans. And it could have just as easily been a white person from Illinois who shot him as a white Southerner, because right. that kind of equality was being resisted so fiercely. There had been such a fierce backlash in that region against those kind of rights.
I mean, in fact, we just earlier this week, from the time that we're recording this, we spoke to Linda Gordon, who has wrote a book about the second coming of the KKK in the 1920s, and the broad-based support, somewhere around 6 million people, maybe, who were identified as KKK at that time.
Many of them were in this region. Mm. And there's sort of an unbroken chain back to the Copperheads movement of the Civil War, which was a pro-Confederacy, pro-slavery whites in this region. And even before that, the mobocrats, what Abraham Lincoln in his first speech, truly his first speech as a young man in his 20s in Illinois, called the mobocrats, right? This is a movement in the 1830s that was sweeping all of the major urban areas of the North to destroy, and was highly organized, but it was to destroy African Americans rising in the cities of the North. So it was burning down schools, meeting halls, churches, middle-class neighborhoods, even an orphanage. This is sweeping most of the major cities of the North in the 1830s. I mean, this is an aspect of the Jacksonian period that we've almost completely lost, but certainly is due some more similar looking at. So when we talk about the resurgence of the Klan in the 1920s, I would argue that that was maybe its third or fourth manifestation, right? But the Klan wasn't just Southern. And it wasn't even just Southern right after the Civil War. As I noted in my book, there was at least one case I've come across in Ohio right after the Civil War in the 1870s, where a wealthy African-American farmer in Dark County, Ohio, was asleep in his bed, and a group of men gathered around his home with white masks over their faces and started shooting into it and killed him.
Wow.
And his two children only managed to escape because they hid under their beds, and they were on the second story. But the local newspaper called it Klan activity. So all I can do and all I can say is that in the bone and sinew of the land, I've done my best to start to resurrect this history. But it is going to take people picking it up, reading it, listening to it on audiobook, asking questions, starting discussions, for us to really understand what we've lost and what we can learn about it today. But in terms of their wealth, where they are today, who they are today, that's something I'm really excited to see come to light. What I know is that some of these farming communities are still in existence. There are still Morrises in Illinois in the Wabash River Valley farming in the same county that the Morris family has farmed for over 200 years.
Mm.
Same in southwestern Indiana, Lyle Station, Indiana. African Americans are farming the same land that their families have farmed for over 150 years. And there's a history of African American land ownership and farming in that county that goes back well over 200 years. I could just start listing them, you know, Western Ohio. I've got that map, but Cass County, Michigan, they are still there. And despite the levels of violence that their communities experienced.
Well, I mean, it's one more, chapter in the repeated dynamic of the expansion of black rights or wealth in this country met with an equal and sometimes overpowering response by whites to attempt to sort of like reverse those gains. And it would be fascinating to know, too, about how successful, because it sounds like they were pretty these white folk are pretty successful in inhibiting and I guess in many cases just stripping this accumulation of black wealth and rights.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason this history has been buried. I'm beginning to discover this. You know, the book has only been out, The Bone and Sinew of the Land has only been out about a month. But it's been really interesting to see the response, because in some of these communities in the Midwest that are overwhelmingly white, the response has been sort of to shut their ears to this, to ignore it, because histories like this don't stay buried without work.
Right.
I often say to people, you know, diversity is the baseline in this nation. It's a monolithic sort of, the idea that the Midwest is, or the rural Midwest, is homogeneous, right, is a myth, but B, a violently created homogeneity. I mean, there's the fact that there are whole swaths of the Midwest that are now, rural Midwest, that are now mainly white, happened through violence, for a reason. And so then it's going to take work to reverse that, whether you're talking about a Fortune 500 company or a county in Michigan, or a school, right, or a community or a neighborhood. The lack of diversity takes real work to create a lack of diversity. It's amazing how easy diversity is if it's not resisted. Mm. It's funny, because a lot of people I talk to act as if, well, you know, we got to have our diversity training. We got to work on making the workplace more diverse. I want to say, well, maybe if, you know, we have to look into why there is a lack of diversity in the first place. Because, and that's, I think this book really starts showing the roots of that. But so much is lost if we reverse diversity, right?
Well, Annalisa Cox, the book is The Bone and Sinew of the Land, America's Forgotten Black Pioneers and the Struggle for Equality. We will put a link at majority.fm, and thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Fascinating piece of history.
Well, thank you for helping to reveal it. I appreciate it.
Here is Dave Rubin at Oxford University in London, right? Or is this in Oxford?
I think it's in Oxford, yep.
There you go. And speaking to some of those hardscrabble folks in Oxford. And this guy is a fan of Dave Rubin's. They're all, you know, I don't know if they're all fans, but this guy's a fan of Dave Rubin's. He's coming up and he wants to ask Dave Rubin a challenging question, right? And I know yesterday Michael played the Jordan Peterson clip with the
civil rights.
Jim Jeffries, where he's asked one of the most fundamental questions you could ask someone like Peterson, as to, you know, like a question that comes up in almost every debate that I have with a libertarian who calls in. And Jordan Peterson's construct is basically libertarian. I mean, I don't think he perceives it as his arguments as being economically founded, but the construct is the same. It is the world is fine as it is, and the imposition of government regulations to help people who are disenfranchised or less well situated than me is oppressive to me. I mean, that's basically his argument, right? And to people like me. And so here is Dave Rubin being asked a question from an ally, but taking on a sort of slightly contrarian for the sake of, you know, the devil's advocate. And just like Jordan Peterson, who couldn't answer the most basic fundamental question that you would imagine, since he's been interviewed, you know, a million times by Dave Rubin alone, would have had to have addressed that question. He couldn't do it. Dave Rubin does not seem to... You know, maybe, and I know people say he's just not up to the intellectual challenge here, but this is not that challenging of a question. But he doesn't seem to even know the slightest bit of what he's talking about. It is fascinating. Let's listen to this question and answer.
that type of progress isn't fast enough. And so in nowadays, in the politics of kind of getting things done and people vote for people who can get that affirmative action, that change done, how would you still kind of come back with your point about being local?
Yeah, well, the first thing I would do is, I hope some of you have seen this, I would send them to my video with Larry Elder.
All right, pause. So the question is that the guy says, and we get the question is, like, you know, do you think there's still systemic racism and people want to vote for people who would address that type of systemic racism and basically, you know, give them the material benefits that they want?
Do is, I hope some of you have seen this, I would send them to my video with Larry Elder, which I suspect some of you guys have seen. This is when I was still a lefty, and I asked Larry Elder, who happens to be black, he's a conservative, I asked him about systemic racism.
All right, pause it for 1 second. Let me just tell you, Larry Elder is, he's a right-wing talk radio host out in California. And I used to listen to Larry Elder back when I worked in L.A., you know, for brief periods of time. And totally follows the conservative script. I sat down with Larry Elder, had an opportunity to meet him at the Democratic Convention 2004. And I remember, you know, and I took what I was doing very seriously at the time. I was, you know, had been a comedian and a director and a writer, and I had just taken the time off to deal with the. I thought maybe I'd probably end this by November of 2004. We started in April. And I remember Larry Elder sat down with Janine Garofalo and I, and he's like, and we just sort of like, we're like, we were off air. How do you do this? And he's like, come on, guys. We're off the field. And we're like, what? He's like, come on, we're off the field. We don't, you know, no need to have game faces on. And we were just like, wait, what? Like, you think what you like, you're just, this is just a job to you?
Was that him, how he reacts generally, or just because he didn't want to get into it with you off mic?
I don't know, but he was almost surprised that we took it that seriously.
Sounds like Larry Elder doesn't take ideas seriously.
Maybe, I don't know, but Dave Rubin's really touting this, but so let's hear what he's got to say.
He basically beat me senseless. I mean, it's a violent, it is a violent video on YouTube. He beat me senseless with facts. Systemic racism, let me just talk about America here, so I'm not going to talk about the UK here. Systemic racism does not exist. There are no laws in America, meaning the system. Doesn't mean racism doesn't exist. Racism exists. There are people who are racist, and you should do everything you can to show them that their ideas are wrong, and that you should not be judging someone based on their race, of course. But the idea that there is systemic racism, meaning that there are laws in place that treat black people differently or Asian people differently or white people differently, simply doesn't exist.
Okay. Now, what Dave is showing here is that he doesn't know what the word systemic racism mean. I think it would be virtually impossible to find anybody who defines systemic racism as a function of laws. Systemic racism means that society is structured in such a way, that institutions behave in such a way, that they prevent people of certain races from, or they disadvantage people from certain races because of their race. And not just because of their race in that moment, because they are descendants of people of a certain race, because their race has, in some respects, defined their circumstances. Now, it doesn't mean that they can't break out of it. Doesn't mean that but that, largely speaking, the structures of society, the system, works against them. Not that there are laws. He's just simply either made that up or just so ignorant about it. I don't know. Or maybe just misremembers what Larry Elder told him. Or maybe that's why he got beat up by Larry Elder in that interview.
Maybe he got a concussion from that.
He wasn't that bright at the time or something. Something happened. But let's continue.
Or white people differently simply doesn't exist. Now, that doesn't mean that we can still do better on certain things. So, for example, often black people will be incarcerated longer for simple crimes that if a white person committed won't be. Now that has to do with more with socioeconomic reasoning, which is why I would be for, if you can get an economy that's as free as possible, you will have more and more people, regardless of the color of their skin, being able to partake in an economy.
Okay, so if I'm to understand him, the reason why there are more black people incarcerated, can we just go back and listen to this again? Because he seems to be saying the reason why there's more people, black people incarcerated is because of socioeconomic reasons. And that if we had an economy that included everyone, then they wouldn't be forced. He doesn't say they wouldn't be forced to commit a crime, but that's the implication. So, and this is why this is so difficult. He at once is saying there's no systemic racism. But then he says that the economy does not include everybody, okay? And presumably those people are the black people that he's talking about who are disproportionately in jail. So he's both saying that there's more people in jail, black people in jail, because they can't participate in the economy, sort of saying like that they're forced into getting arrested for drug crimes at a higher rate, even though we all know white people have as much, if not more, the drugs than black people do. He's ignoring that aspect of it and then blaming on the fact that black people can't participate in the economy, which apparently to him is not a function of systemic racism. It's a function of somehow, I guess, an economy that just coincidentally left off the people who have been historically racially oppressed in this country. So let's just go back and listen to this, because his inability even to maintain his own internal logic for the course of a sentence and a half is almost artistic.
Differently, simply doesn't exist. Now, that doesn't mean that we can still do better on certain things. So, for example, often black people will be incarcerated longer for simple crimes that if a white person committed, won't be. Now, that has to do with socioeconomic reasoning, which is why
How is it that if black people are committing the same crimes as white people, but they're incarcerated more, how is that socioeconomic? How is that not systemic racism? And even, like, what does that mean? It's socioeconomic.
Well, he is dumb, and I don't want to ascribe any kind of good analysis to him. But yes, if you want to go back to the beginning, the creation of race and racism, that arose from capitalism and wanting to make money off of human beings who were enslaved. But that's clearly not the argument he's making.
No, it's not. I don't know what it is he's making. Maybe he's arguing that because black people don't have the resources to get good lawyers that get them off.
They turn to crime. It's that whole thing. Like as a true libertarian, I would think you would say maybe, hey, are we policing these groups of people more vigilantly than other groups of people? For instance, that might explain.
But that would
crime
be
statistics.
Systemic racism, wouldn't it?
That would be.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, he concedes that black people are not treated equally by the justice system in the first sentence. And then he says, but it's socioeconomic reasons, which it's almost impossible to know what he means by that, except for the only explanation later is that there are people who are systemically kept out of the economy, which would also be instructive of systemic evidence of a systemic racism.
Because the problem with our economy is it's not libertarian enough right now.
Or if you can get an economy that's as free as possible, you will have more and more people, regardless of the color of their skin, being able to partake in an economy. But, you know, it's so funny because this is where the Democrats have sort of owned a lot of the minority communities. And I think Candace Owens and Kanye, believe it or not, are the leaders out. I mean, I really think they are. But if you think about this, about the worst places in the United States for black people to live in terms of economics, in terms of shootings, it's Chicago, it's Ferguson, it's Atlanta. It's these places that have been run by Democrats almost exclusively for 80 years. Yet the Democrats keep saying, we're for black people. So it's sort of like saying, I'm a progressive, I'm for a progressive. It sounds good. Well, I'm for black people. Everyone's for black, you know, unless you're a true racist, you're for black people the same way you should be for everybody else. So they've tricked you into thinking, I mean, Chicago, I would guess, someone should check the numbers on this, but I'm going to guess about 50 to 80 people, black people, were shot in Chicago this past weekend. You never hear about
it. So pause it now for a second. So here he is. This is the guy who decries making everything political, right? here he is trying to explain that there's no systemic racism, but somehow because Democrats have controlled, certainly not Ferguson, but in Chicago, and I don't know for how many years it's been Atlanta, there's certain attributes I think I associate with Georgia that may also indicate why there might be some long-term problems there. But that somehow that is indicative of why there's no systemic racism, because those cities, which have been controlled, he says, by Democrats, nominally speaking, but proves there's no systemic racism.
Well, affirmative action, as the guy who asked the question mentioned in his question, someone should ask Dave Rubin if he considers that structural racism.
That if the actual, I think that British guy was not using affirmative action in the way that we use it.
Yeah, okay,
I think he was
enough.
Just saying like actual action that is proactive in some way. But wait, is there more to this one? Or yeah. Yeah. This is great now. Okay, so he goes through the sort of the tired analysis of Chicago. You know, is not there's a lot of murders in Chicago. Therefore, there's no systemic racism because that's controlled by Democrats, which of course makes absolutely no sense.
Well, Democrats have sold out working class people of all different races.
Yes,
but
that's
it's not
fine,
because
but that's not
they weren't neoliberal enough.
Right. Exactly.
Closely black on black crime. Well, if the Democrats are so good at fixing these problems, why is it that in their cities, it's always the worst? And it's because they create these incentives that are actually disincentives. And if you give people things, it becomes very hard to not want those things anymore. And I can give you, I know that anecdotal stuff isn't always the best way, but I can give you one.
Pause it. First of all, it's not anecdotal, but whatever, I misspeak too. So now he's moved to trying to prove that the problem with a city like Chicago, controlled by Democrats, is that the reason why things haven't, why there's such a high murder rate in Chicago is because people, when they get things, they don't want to give up these things right now. So like the idea is that there's been such goodies for black people in Chicago.
Got to protect the Obama phones.
That they... that there is a high murder rate. But let's see where he's going, because, you know, anecdotes aren't necessarily as good as data, but sometimes they can
some qualitative texture.
Yeah.
I know that anecdotal stuff isn't always the best way, but I can give you one very good example. My sister lives on the Upper West Side of New York City. It's a nice area. Mm-hmm. She pays a ton to live in a nice area with a doorman building in New York City. A good portion of her building, I think it might be 50%, is rent subsidized, meaning that they're keeping rents low for certain people of certain ethnicities.
Let me explain this. To get certain zoning variances, buildings in this city sometimes, and I imagine that she's in one of these West Side, like far West Side buildings on the Upper West Side, right? Yeah, the Trump building, very possibly. To get the zoning variances, you're required to have some apartments in these buildings. It's usually not 50%, but whatever. Let's call it 50%. It's usually like 20 or 30%, whatever, that are rent stabilized, so that people who are either living in, well, it's not really, I wouldn't say living in poverty, but I would say lower income people relative to New York City have the opportunity to live in the building, because we don't want to drive too many people out. But go back a little bit, because it is, you have to earn a maximum amount, right? Like if I earn $150,000 a year, I'm not eligible for this one bedroom apartment because my income's too high. That is it. Dave perceives that there's something else going on with why you have these rent stabilized. Listen carefully. See if you can pick this up.
On the Upper West Side of New York City, it's a nice area. Mm-hmm. She pays a ton to live in a nice area with a doorman building in New York City. A good portion of her building, I think it might be 50%, is rent subsidized, meaning that they're keeping rents low for certain people of certain ethnicities to live there.
They're not keeping the money, the rents low for certain ethnicities. This is wholly made up in his mind. Okay? He has completely made up the idea that there's, now by ethnicities, I'm going to be generous, and he means the Italians, Greeks, the Polish, the Greeks, right? Certain ethnicities. That's why the rent is kept low. So here's a guy who's arguing there's no systemic racism and can't even get through this conversation without saying that they keep the rents low for blacks or Puerto Ricans.
Well, he means there's no systemic racism against people of color. Come on now.
That's right. Okay, so continue.
Rents low for certain people of certain ethnicities to live there, to live in a very nice area in a very nice building. Now imagine if that was you for a minute, and the guy next to you was paying $3,000 to live in the apartment, and you are paying $400. Would you ever not want that to be? You wouldn't. It's just the truth. You would, and then it gives you a disincentive to make more money, because once you make more money, they're going to take away your benefit.
Wait, we got to keep going, right? Oh, does it? He says he's going to move. So here he is saying that the problem with Chicago is that they're getting a benefit, that they're getting to live in a nicer place than they can afford because it's being subsidized by the state. Now, he could argue, I don't want to do that money, but he's saying it's like creating a disincentive for you to make more money. And then look where he goes with what this ultimately leads to in terms of this disincentive, right? Here it is. He goes and he says, this is going to be a problem with
closely
like,
black on black crime. Well, if the Democrats right, are so good at fixing it.
And so he's saying now that there's a disincentive for you to make more money. I don't know how this leads to the fact that there's not systemic racism. I don't know how we got from, is there systemic racism in this country, to my sister is oppressed because someone in her building is not paying $3,000 a month for an apartment.
Well, he believes in systemic racism against white people, I think.
Exactly. Here we go.
New York City. A good portion of her building, I think it might be 50%, is rent subsidized, meaning that they're keeping rents low for certain people of certain ethnicities to live there, to live in a very nice area in a very nice building. Now imagine if that was you for a minute, and the guy next to you was paying $3,000 to live in the apartment, and you are paying $400. Would you ever not want that to be? You wouldn't. It's just the truth. You would, and then it gives you a disincentive to make more money, because once you make more money, they're going to take away your benefit. And then what are you going to have to do? You're going to have to leave your nice area, and you're going to have to move 100 blocks north, if not out of the city altogether.
So now he's arguing that the rent stabilization should not exist for these people, because if they make more money, just a little bit, they're going to lose their thing, and they're going to have to move out of New York City, which is a horrible fate, apparently. So he's basically saying like only rich people should be able to live in New York City, and people aren't going to want to make more money. But if that's the case, then why is his sister? Why doesn't his sister just say, I'm going to make less money so I get the cheaper apartment? Because his sister might also want to go out to dinner. And his sister might have a kid and want to spend the $150 it's going to be for a babysitter to go out to dinner. Because it's better to be rich than to be poor, even with that subsidy.
And why is his solution to take away subsidized housing instead of just giving it to everyone?
Because
it's almost like he's got some ulterior agenda.
If you get subsidized housing, you're going to enjoy it. And then the murder rate will go up because you're of a certain ethnicity.
It's bizarre.
Where does he go? Wait, where does he just go after that?
Exactly where the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I don't believe these people are evil. I don't believe that the Democrats that put these some of them I think are evil and want to control people, but that's a small sliver. I think the average person who's voting for these policies, they think they're doing the right thing. And this is where I would say watch my interview with Larry Elder, and then especially watch my interview with the great Thomas Sowell, and read every book by Thomas Sowell, and understand that every time they have tried to make things better for specific people, they make it worse for everybody.
Pause it. Those rent stabilizations are not for specific people. They are not for any specific ethnicities.
Well, it's weird the way he's substituting race for class here, because I think that's a thing a lot of American dum-dums do, not limited to Dave Rubin, but like it's almost like a dark mirror I don't want to compare him in any way to the left because he's an idiot. But like, it's almost like a dark mirror to like the class reductionists who think that if you can attack capitalism, that will solve racism and sexism for everyone. Only his solution is to make the economy even more neoliberal and laissez-faire. And
I don't even think he goes that far.
Fix it.
I just think he thinks the problem is that we're giving the certain ethnicities, too many benefits, and
how
they're getting
so
spoiled. That's what the problem is.
How do you think those conversations with his sister really went?
I mean...
These damn Croats next to me.
Yes.
I can't stand them.
Ugh, all I do is I smell pasta all the time. I can't stand these high ties.
Folks, speaking of guys from the Boston area, I believe Joe Rogan is from that area. That is where I first met him and last saw him, probably.
We played softball.
Softball.
He didn't meet you, though.
Oh, well,
Ooh.
We'll see. But this is really, I mean, there's, this is really something. So Dave Rubin got off tour. And I don't know, which one should we start? Let's start with the building codes. I got to tell you, you know, a lot of times we will play a clip of someone. And the reason why I play the clip is because I want to point out some of the falsehoods, maybe, or the misapprehensions, or the ignorance.
You're cleaning up the public record.
Cleaning up the public record. In this instance, I have to say, Joe Rogan already did it in many respects. And in some ways, this is just simply hilarious to me.
Extremely funny.
What's that? No, not yet. We're going to... Well, let's play this clip. And I may stop it. Now, I also wanted to say that there was a clip from the same interview about the post office that still is bouncing around in my head. And Michael played it yesterday. I should have embargoed that because I have never seen the depths of ignorance that... were contained in such a small amount of content. Almost not every word, because of course every words themselves cannot be ignorant. They need to be paired with other words so that they turn into even just brief phrases, which would reveal the ignorance. The level of ignorance in his talking about the post office, You could almost take any three words. If you were to take the transcript and choose any three words in that transcript, there would be something so ignorant embedded in that those three words that it would be impressive. But his ability to put them together into clauses and into statements and into sentences, it's almost like if it was an art project. But we do have him continuing on talking about building codes
directly after the
and I imagine, you know, Rogan may have spent a little bit of time, you know, with folks who build stuff, and anybody who knows anything about building knows why you have building codes. Maybe anybody who's bought a house too would probably know. Anybody watched Homes on Homes?
Rented an apartment?
Yes.
Rented an apartment, been in a building?
Yeah.
Walked inside of, or as referenced in this
now,
clip,
here's the thing about
been
this.
Into a country where there are not tough building code regulations.
Right.
Is another
or
way.
Read about countries where there's
or
not
read,
tough.
Or
like
seen
the first thing
on
you
TV.
Read. Well, all right, let's play the clip.
That's the way you get them. You get them through the U.S. Postal Service.
But
you don't get them through UPS.
I'm pretty sure, though, that if the USPS stopped, it didn't exist anymore, you'd still get chickens delivered. And Amazon could probably do it even more effectively. That's my point. It's like, I'm not saying these things have to be eliminated tomorrow. I'm not
pause
even really
it,
calling
pause
for them.
Pause it. Okay. So, Dave Rubin, we're catching the tail end of the post office thing where Dave Rubin doesn't realize that Amazon relies on the U.S. Postal Service for a huge percentage of its deliveries. But he's just saying that Amazon would pick up the cost of that.
I guess, theoretically. Understand that Amazon's retail business does not make its money. I don't know if they're net cash negative still, but most of their money comes from their server, their electronic server thing. The delivery mechanism, there's so much stupidity just even involved in the tail end. This is not even part of the clip. And there's so dumb.
The tail end that you're catching there is him just basically using an example to bash the post office. Then being like, then Rogan be like, oh, no, wait, you're actually talking about the post office. And him being like, oh, yeah, but I still think it would be better if not.
Right.
Like that, no, that was literally his recovery.
So much ignorance in it. It's just stunning. And yes, he's saying like, well, I'm not even talking about what I'm talking about is what he's saying here. This isn't even the clip that we wanted to talk about. This is just the tail end of the last clip. But go ahead.
I'm really calling for them to be eliminated. But just generally, what problem would you have? Everything you're building here right now, right? Do you want the government to tell you how to do all these things and all the regulations that you got to have your electric thing this far from this and like all
the regulations like that for construction are important though. You do have to make sure that people don't do stupid shit.
But generally,
you don't have a power lines near a water line. There's a lot of.
But I would put most of that on the builders though. They want to build things that are good. Now I get it.
That's not true. Listen, people are going to build corners all the time. Like you have to have regulations when it comes to construction methods.
Pause it. Let me tell you.
Oh, that's not true.
Most people know this. But if you didn't, you could watch, like I say, like Homes on Homes. Like, there are multiple TV series on Home Improvement Network that are just about builders not knowing code, not building to code, building stuff that there's like mold in the walls, the electrical system keeps shorting out because it's too close to the water, they haven't done the drainage system correctly, they haven't done the air duct system correctly. I mean, this goes on and on and on. I mean, you don't have to have listened to this show to talk about the massive lawsuits in terms of builders cutting corners. In fact, the whole bedrock of regulations is because in the pursuit of money, people will cut corners. And they will do so even if it means harm to other individuals.
Even with Yelp reviews?
Even with Yelp reviews. And apparently Dave Rubin's not aware of this at all. But the best is to look at the expression on his face. Because if I was to critique, and we still have a little bit more of left of this
lot more of this.
But if I was to critique this clip at all, I would say to Joe Rogan, release just the camera 2 shot. I want to see Dave Rubin's reaction throughout all of this.
When Rogan's speaking.
Because the look on Dave Rubin's face every time they cut to Rogan, because Rogan just completely shut him down, is like a lost puppy. A lost puppy that realizes he's drowning and is trying to salvage himself. But continue.
That's not true. Listen, people cut corners all the time. Like you have to have regulations when it comes to construction methods, or people are going to get fucked.
They cut corners when there are regulations anyway.
They do. They would cut a lot more if there weren't regulations.
I'm not totally.
You go to third world countries and look at construction methods.
Pause it for 1 second. So Rubin uses the defense. Well, you can have laws, but people are going to break them. So under that theory, right, there would be no laws because every law has been broken at least once. So why have any laws?
Why not just have the purge 24/7?
Right, exactly. It's just a constant rotating.
You'd be incentivized not to purge because you'd want people to hire you to build.
HGTV needs a purge.
All right, go back a little bit and then play.
A lot more if there weren't regulations.
I'm not totally.
You go to third world countries and look at construction methods, they're fucking dangerous.
Yeah.
That's why schools collapse on kids in foreign countries sometimes.
I'm not telling you that I'm against all regulation, period. That's where I said intellectually I like that argument because you can make I think you can make a very sound argument that competition would force people to do better work.
Pause it. In fact, we have now moved to Dave Rubin saying that maybe someone else could make a sound argument that competition would force people to self-regulate. I apparently don't have the ability to do that, but I'm aware that there are people who do that. But I have shown that even though I am paid on my show by people who professionally profess this, right? He gets money from the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers' raison d'etre as a political force is to unshackle their businesses from regulations that prevent them from maximizing their profits at the expense of society, to put their externalities out on other people. In other words, consumers are going to pay, citizens are going to pay for our profit by either, you know, paying for the health care they need for their asthma, or paying for the cleanup that they need to make sure that their rivers aren't poisoned, or whatever it is. I'm going to externalize these costs in my profit making. Dave Rubin is paid by these people. And Dave Rubin can't even make the most basic argument to it. In fact, he can barely escape by saying, I'm aware that there are arguments about this. I can't articulate them. I mean, here's the thing about Dave Rubin that is most appalling to me. I don't think Dave Rubin has read upon any of the topics he's talked about for more than 5 minutes, maybe ever. Like, if you know you're going on a show, and maybe he thought that Rogan wouldn't in any way question him whatsoever. But if you're going to go and make an argument that, private enterprise could do better than the government, you don't choose the post office, which is arguably one of the premier examples of the development of civilization that we have. Like, the Postal Service is, what it does is so amazing that it provides postal service to almost every single corner, if not every single corner of this country, is amazing, and it does it with zero tax dollars.
And it's such an enlightenment / free exchange of ideas idea of an origin anyway.
It is like, it's the pinnacle. It's like the foundation of everything that he pretends to argue for. Like, I could see you saying, like, you like the DMV? Just because that's the most hack thing.
That's the hack one.
Well,
right.
But the problem is, of course, there is no federal DMV, right? There's only the states which he would like to have.
Sure, he doesn't know that.
No, though. He doesn't know that.
I'm surprised he didn't use DMV.
The post office, as a federal agency, the only thing that has inhibited the operation of the post office, ladies and gentlemen, is the Republican Party and their attempts to force the post office to privatize is the only thing that has inhibited the operations
but
of the post office.
But you could make a very sound case that with, like, Amazon and drones and blah, 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 that, like, things will, like, prices will lower.
Yeah, you could.
Such.
You could, but I can't. One could, but I can't. I'm not going to.
A lot of other people make those obvious arguments, which I just completely humiliated myself
it's
in
just
attempting,
like,
to make.
Do 5 minutes of reading. Like, if you're going to go, like, you know, Google some of the words that you intend to use and just read what you find at the end of them.
I'm more interested in ideas.
At least go to Liberty University, you know, who gives you your funding or whatever it is, you know, the Liberty Foundation, Freedom Foundation, and watch one of their videos so at least you can regurgitate their points and, you know, practice it. Practice it with somebody so that you cannot make a total ass of yourself. For gosh sakes, you make a living at this. You make a damn living espousing this bullshit. Don't you feel some obligation to read 5 minutes into an argument so you can avoid the most you want to talk about building codes?
And by the way,
like, you picked both those topics.
And let me
too.
Just
like,
say,
yeah,
Dave,
this is like the low-hanging fruit.
And if
fruit.
These videos upset you, think of them as Yelp reviews to incentivize you to do
yes,
better as a small
yes,
businessman.
Yes, in fact, I mean, I feel like the government should step in and regulate what you're doing, because obviously, like, clearly, like, you're not doing your job
there
well.
There needs to be a federal bureaucrat who says, look, you can advocate all of the demented nonsense you want. We have a First Amendment. But if you're going to do it in such a recklessly incompetent way.
I mean, you need an example of why a builder might cut corners and deliver a subpar product? Watch your videos of yourself. You want an example of how someone could continue to make money hand over fist and not know what they're doing? Look at your YouTube channel. Look at your bank account.
Look within.
Exactly. The truth lies within
refresh
you.
Refresh your Patreon page. The truth lies within your Patreon analytics.
Exactly. My gosh. Let's go to a 509 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Samuel Cedar, I presume.
Yes.
Long-time listener, first-time caller from the Hall of Presidents in sunny Orlando, Florida.
Wow.
At Disney Resorts. Tis I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Oh, well, hello, Franklin Delano.
Samuel,
yes.
Yesterday I tuned in to your show late and could hear you were quite distraught about something, but I did not hear the news. Tell me, was there a collapse of the global markets leaving tens of millions of Americans homeless, jobless, and scrapping for their next meal?
No, not...
Did the Japanese engage in a surprise attack? And believe me, it was a complete surprise, which resulted in thousands of dead Americans while plunging us into a bloody global war over the future of civilization?
No, it was,
And tell me, Samuel, do your legs still work?
They do, yes, barely.
Then pull yourself together, for Christ's sake. In my day, when they tried to own the libs, I lined up all the Republicans in Congress shoulder to shoulder and had Eleanor push my chair down the line while I whipped each of them square in the balls with my cane. Yes, they did everything they could to stop my greatest accomplishments, like, say, I don't know, a little thing you may have heard of. What's it called? Social fucking security.
Right, I've heard of that. That's one of my favorites.
Yes. Yes, Sam, things are bleak. And now you've had your day to mourn, to wander the streets of New York like a sad, pathetic dog with your tail between your legs. But today you sharpen your shiv because you're in a motherfucking prison yard fight, Sam. Now go bury that toothbrush handle in the jugular of the biggest, meanest man in the clink, metaphorically speaking, of course.
Yes. Well, I appreciate that.
Now I must jump, as they say, before the more troubling parts of my legacy get brought up, like the Japanese internment camps, my treatment of the Negroes, or that time I fucked my cousin.
Thank you. Wow.
The more you know.
Yeah.
That was very edutaining.
That, yeah, you know, I got, it was not a New York area code, too. That was the odd part. Or a Florida one.
He might be down taking the springs.
That's right. Well, I mean, he is from the Hall of Presidents. I mean, as far as we know, he is dead. Calling from a 208 area code.